For millennia, cities have had both a push and a pull effect. It was Dr. Johnson who famously said, "If you're tired of London, you're tired of life." But a century later, the great pamphleteer William Cobbett called London the Great When. Our guest this week, Professor Greg Clark, focuses on all things pull. He is Mr. Cities. His main aim is to ensure that the cities of the future can be all that we want, sources of dynamism, while accommodating climate change. Few other social scientists can say they've worked with 300 cities, and Greg's immense experience has led him to chairing the Connected Places Catapult, the UK's innovation accelerator for cities. He's been a panel expert on a BBC World Service series that examines what makes a perfect city, and he also chairs Transport for London's Land and Property Committee, which, wait for it, oversees TfL's property and housing ventures. Lots going on for you, Greg. Thank you for making the time for us at the We Society. And my opening question is my same offer all my guests, actually, which is, when we called you and said, come on, the We Society, what was your first thought?
Well, my first thought was it'd be nice to have a chat with you, Will, so it's great to be here. And my second thought was, well, actually, one of the things I like about the We Society and also being a fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences is that we get to do interdisciplinary work. And if you love cities in the way that I love cities, then you know geography, economics, sociology, political science, and also history and biology and chemistry and physics all become very important to you. So let's talk about the We Society, because I believe, as I'm sure we're going to discuss, that cities are the places where we can create the society of us and we, not the society of them.
They're also places of social tension. They're also locus of conflict. It all happens in cities. And isn't that really the part of what your position is?
Absolutely right. That, you know, in a sense, that as our society urbanizes, and, you know, my frame of reference is a sort of 100-year perspective and a global perspective, I suppose, we're on this journey from roughly 2.3 billion people living in cities to 9.3 billion people living in cities 100 years later, 1980 to 2080. So it's necessary.
Hold on. 2.3 billion people living in cities in 1980, and then in 2080...
9.3 billion, right?
Those are really big numbers.
Huge. Well, I think it's the slightly unconscious backdrop to our lives, Will, that urbanisation is happening all over the world very rapidly. 1980 was a pivotal moment because we synchronised, I think, for the first time, mass urbanisation in the global south, inspired by the Celtic Tiger economies, with reurbanization in the global north as we shifted towards creative industries, financial and professional services, and everything else. So although in Europe, in North America, in Oceania, urbanization levels are already at 82-83%
of the population,
the rest of the world is catching up very, very rapidly. So humankind is on a kind of anthropological trek to becoming an urban species and all the adaptation that goes with it.
It's only possible because, cities have become livable. 150 years ago, cities were kind of dens of disease, and you got robbed. They weren't pleasant places.
Sure.
But it's been, actually medicine, transport, technology have made cities really possible and lovable, actually.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. And, you know, I talk a lot to people about the magic of cities. And what I say is, firstly, you know, network effects make everybody more productive. Secondly, density, when it works, makes us more environmentally efficient.
Now, by density, don't mean my IQ. Mean the numbers of people living in a square kilometre or a square mile.
Yes, I mean the frugality with which we use urban land and our ability to accommodate more things in the same space in order to make that urban land both more productive and also more sustainable. So I'd say there are five elements to the magic of cities, and the urban innovation one that you just mentioned, I think, is the fifth. But I would start by saying network effects make us all more productive, agglomeration and everything else. Density effects make us more efficient.
Okay, go ahead.
Right. Connectivity, the connectivity effects of having cities as hubs makes us more connected with opportunity and with the rest of the world. And then there's an openness effect that makes us more diverse and more creative. And then there's an innovation effect because we crowd in people and assets and resources into cities. When problems arise, like the things you mentioned, the urban squalor, the health problems, and now, of course, climate change, cities are the sites of innovation, and that's where we solve the cyclical problems of evolution, and then we implement them in subsequent cycles, which is why our cities have got better, become more livable.
But where, I mean, all cities, in a sense, have those five characteristics, or they wouldn't be cities. I mean, that's why I call them a city.
That's right.
But some cities work better than others. I mean, yes. We can all think of cities we love and cities we don't love. Mm-hmm. Actually, what is your favourite city?
Well, I think there's a big mix of cities that I like. But, you know, I love Vienna's livability. I love Shanghai.
Have you lived in Vienna?
I've not lived in Vienna, but I've stayed there, I guess, for about 6 months over time. So I've spent a lot of time in Vienna. And the quality of life, the affordability of life there, the quality of urban neighbourhoods, very, very high. But a city that in social terms has many limitations. So great for livability. If you want nightlife, Shanghai, I think, if you like live music and things like that. But if you want an example of a big city that really works, you know, there's a kind of Tokyo, Seoul, Singapore story here. Tokyo over 30 million, Seoul 20 million, Singapore pushing towards 10 million. These cities are the illustration of the perfect combination of high-capacity public transport, medium-density, high-amenity living, massive investment in public space that creates a place that's livable for a large number of people. But then there are other kinds of cities, and London and New York are foremost amongst them, where it's the openness, the diversity, the civic freedom that gives them their particular angle. So different cities for different purposes, I would say.
OK, I'm glad you mentioned London, because I'm born in London.
Me too.
Live in London.
Yeah.
I'm a Londoner. And I actually love the place.
Yeah.
But it's a series of villages, really, connected by kind of very, very good public transport, actually. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, with its kind of West End and city kind of as two poles of kind of creativity and commerciality. I mean, I've always thought that.
Yeah. Well, I go back to 1067 and think about how after the Norman conquest, the good burghers of the city of London did the deal with the new king, which was that they would give him their allegiance if he allowed them their civic and political freedoms. And I think in that deal in 1067, something was struck in London that's about this combination of freedom of association, freedom of thought, freedom of identity that has created a sense of diversity and creativity, a commitment to discovery, to science and to other things that have led to London being this amazingly innovative city in all sorts of ways. And you couple that then with London's geography, a tidal river that flows in and out east to west, a westerly wind that blows ships out towards Europe and blows the smells away, and you end up with a city that is perfectly formed to have a big enough scale that the 100 villages can almost operate independently of each other from a local point of view. But at a metropolitan level, they add up to much more in terms of a labour market, an innovation system, a transport system and everything else.
I know the cities in Britain are beginning to get there. I mean, London has for so long kind of dominated. But, you know, I notice in Manchester, I see the big, you know, it's got a way to go, but given where it was 30 years ago, it's come a long way. Glasgow, I'm very enthusiastic about Edinburgh. Yep. I should tell the truth, there's very few English cities I don't like. I went to university in Bristol. I mean, that was a great city, you know. So come on, I mean, it's not as much the kind of 10 top cities in England and Scotland and Wales that are problematic. It's the next tier down, which are really kind of struggling with. where they've got less than 250,000 people. Yeah. And they're in a bit of trouble, aren't they?
I think that's right, Will. Yes. I mean, I think there are 30 British cities that are doing well, actually. And I'm a fan of all of them. And you've listed several of them. But I would also add Birmingham and Leeds. And, you know, Liverpool's doing very well. Glasgow and Manchester, I think, are leaders. But I think Bristol and Cardiff are excellent cities, too. So those cities are doing well. If they've got a university, if they've got a diverse economy, if they've got an airport, it helps.
Yep.
If they've got, a mainline railway station that links to one of the main routes, they tend to be doing well. If they're a smaller city or a town that was dependent on one industry or one kind of consumer base, for example, some of the coastal cities in the north, or they were one industrial town, they've had much more problems adjusting. And they've got locked into a very pernicious cycle, I think, of population loss, lower grade economic activity, and it's been hard for them to transition into a new kind of economy and a new kind of path. But one of, I think, the opportunities is to better connect all of these cities with one another. So a big problem has been the paucity of investment in our transport systems. And many of those smaller towns, I think, have a future, but they have a future being better connected to the larger cities around them that are doing well.
That was one of the points, of course, in the Levelling Up white paper. I mean, leave aside one's politics. I thought chapters 1 and chapter 2 of the Levelling Up white paper, one of the best I've read by British government on this subject. I don't know whether that's your view. I mean, it makes two of your points, actually. One, it makes this point about that, if you want to level up, you've got to get city dynamism. Mm-hmm. And the key to city dynamism in large parts of the north and the Midlands, and the precondition for it, lies in better connectivity. Yeah. And actually what's happening at the moment in the North England transport system is actually outrageous, isn't it? The travel to work times, you can live 20 miles away from the centre of Manchester or centre of Leeds, and it can take you an hour and a half, 2 hours to get to work. I mean, it's amazing.
Well, I'm lucky enough to be on the Board of Transport for London, as you mentioned, so I'm acutely aware of how London benefits from the transport system that it has. It's not without its problems, and by international comparators, there are still things we want to do to make TfL better. But I absolutely agree that the gulf in connectivity between what we have in London and the South East and what we have in the rest of the country is pernicious and cruel, actually. And I think it prevents what would be a much greater level of economic diversity and dynamism in those places, and much more of those scale effects that I talked about. Part of this magic is that connectivity produces scale effects, which means that the Manchester labour market effectively becomes 10 million people, not 1 million, or the Glasgow labour market becomes 3 million people, not 1 million. And you need those scale effects if you're going to deliver high value added activity.
Now, here you are. We're, I think, 10, 15 minutes into this conversation, and you chair the Connected
Places Catapult.
The Connected Places Catapult, not the Connected Cities Catapult, Connected Places Catapult.
Yeah.
Now, in that title, there's, I guess the secret of what you're going to do. I mean, you're always going to accent connectivity. But, I mean, all this knowledge, all this work you've done around the world, and here we are as a national community facing a deep recession, and actually there being a degree of consensus across parties that actually urban recovering and accelerating urban dynamism is going to be a trigger to the kind of growth we need. And they look to you, Greg, and they say, come on, you chair the Connected Places Catapult. Mm-hmm. Give us a hand. What are you going to say to them?
Well, I'm going to say I think we know how to do three things that we didn't know how to do before. And it's partly because I think we've got some new tools. So let me just say something about the new tools. I think that if you look at this new cycle that we're entering now, and I think a lot in sort of 10, 15 year cycles, loosely correlated with business cycles. In this new cycle, the three new tools are, one, the exponential technologies that we both know a little bit about that I think are changing the way we can orchestrate and integrate places with each other, whether it's digital twins or it's IoT or it's machine learning or it's all sorts of digital platforms.
IoT is the Internet of Things.
Yes. And I think we're moving towards an Internet of Cities, where, you know, the bus can talk to the road and the road can talk to the office and the office can talk to the person who's coming to work and those sorts of things. So if you like, the real-time experience of the city augmented through digital technologies is becoming possible. So new technologies is one new source. Second big source, I think, is intentional capital. Now, sounds a funny thing to say, and of course, we you know, our financial system, particularly our private sector financial system, is suffering from all sorts of stresses. But one of the things that has happened in the last cycle is that simply big capital has become much more interested in urban assets, whether they're infrastructure, whether they're real estate, logistics, ports, airports, universities, student housing, all of that stuff. There's suddenly a much bigger private sector appetite for that, which creates an opportunity but also a challenge. And then the third one is what I would call the new art of place leadership, where I think starting with cities like Manchester and Glasgow, we've begun to see that city leaders in the UK have realised they're never going to have the formal powers of a German state city or the formal powers of a Singapore or a New York. But they have got some soft power. And the soft power is a convening power of bringing together partners to form alliances, to build things together. And you begin to see this with the universities. You begin to see it with the rail companies, with the NHS and others. So I think we've got these three new tools. And I think the three things we can do is, firstly, help all places to better manage people's experience of place. After the pandemic, it's very important that we switch out of cities trying to be simply efficient places for consumption, for commuters or for corporates. And we switch in to cities being more innovative, more habitable and a better experience. And so I think we know a bit more how to do that now.
Do we? I'm cheering you on, actually. Yeah. But I'm also thinking to myself, you know, so much of the infrastructure in the UK and the residential infrastructure is kind of, you know,
Well, that's going to be my
pre-Second World War. I mean, you know, people talk about, you know, retrofitting the housing stock to kind of promote energy efficiency savings and has to air source and ground source heat pumps and all. But actually, some of these houses are completely, you know, unconvertible. I mean, the expense of doing it is ridiculous. And so, you know, one's stuck with the stock. I mean, I'm struck by when you look at a kind of residential road in suburban England in 1935, it looks just the same today in 2022. I mean, and you know, how can one change that?
Well, this is going to be my second point, so let's go for it. I think that we have now a move away from what we would call the old Treasury Green Book rules that made it almost impossible for us to justify the kind of investment we wanted to make in transport and retrofit and everything else, because it didn't make sense in narrow economic terms. Now, most of these investments make much more sense in social and environmental terms. They have many more multipliers, positive spillover effects. And I think that we're moving towards a much better framing of public investment, which I think will draw in private investment. So I think that's the second thing we can do differently this time. So the first one is about re-equipping our cities for the next cycle, not the last one, habitat, innovation, experience. Second one is new ways of investing. And I think the third thing we can do is rapidly accelerate our knowledge economy activities. It seems to me that, I mean, you've said this yourself, Will, that, you know, one of the great endowments of British cities that is almost unique in the world is that every large British city more or less has an excellent university in it. Yeah. And our ability, therefore, to leverage R&D into new kinds of economic activity, I think, is critical to this cycle. So that's, in a sense, where the catapult's at.
Do you know the university that has the highest number of startups in the UK?
I don't know where it is, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's in the West Midlands.
It's Northumbria University.
Northumbria, okay.
And I mean, there you go. I mean, you just the scope, you know, for these universities to get going and to kind of, you know, get the startups, the scale ups, and all.
It's our secret weapon.
Just a quick break in the conversation to talk to you very briefly about the organisation behind the We Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business, the list goes on. From listening to the podcast, you'll hear that social scientists are at the forefront of tackling the most pressing issues of our time, from the cost of living crisis to the war in Ukraine. in every public or private sector strategy room in London, Edinburgh, Cardiff or Belfast. You'll find a social scientist. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences' work, support us or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. You can follow us on Twitter at acadsocsciences and tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. Now, look, you know, we've been talking for a few minutes now, and your enthusiasm is kind of extraordinary. I mean, you're just, you know, hardly keep you in your chair, you know. Your arms are up, you know, you're sort of bouncing up and down. I mean, how did Greg Clark get into all of this? I mean, what are the roots of your enthusiasm for cities?
Well, I think on a very simple level, Will, I grew up in South London, and so did I. Yeah, and not in an attractive part. You know, I love Morden, where I grew up, and I went to school in Wimbledon, and I sort of got to know London, basically exploring it on the underground. I fell in love with the London Underground system. And as soon as I had the chance to live anywhere else, I went for a year and a half between A-levels and university, and I spent 9 months in Mexico City and 6 months in New York at the age of 18. And I worked with orphans and street kids and other things, and I did voluntary work in both cities. But I just fell in love with the energy and the rhythm of the city. And for me, the most compelling thing was that somehow the city seemed to me to be a mechanism for synchronizing human endeavor in such a way that people would do things together in very large numbers. And I found that extremely exciting, and I still find that very exciting today.
But there's lots of people who between school and university, you know, work in cities, but they didn't end up giving advice to 300 cities worldwide about how to do stuff better. I mean, come on. I mean, there's a kind of missing link here.
Well, I suppose it's you know, this is the We Society podcast, isn't it? So my view is that we do live in a society where social capital is very important to us. Human beings are social animals. The city is increasingly the preferred domain in which that social animal inhabits. And if we can make our cities perform better and work better for everyone, we're doing a service to our fellow humans and to our planet. And the intriguing complexity of the whole thing will fire our minds and our hearts for 100 years. So why not do this?
Well, you've certainly convinced me, but I must convince our listeners. I mean, let's just do a little bit more prodding about this. What are the origins of it? I mean, in the Levelling Up white paper, they talk about the Medici effect.
Yeah.
And I was very struck by that. It got mocked by Lisa Nandy in the House of Commons, which I thought was a pity. I mean, what the writers were trying to capture was that actually the Medici's in Florence, in the Renaissance Florence, like other cities in Renaissance Italy, kind of really lit the blue touch paper and off it went. I mean, that incubated the Renaissance and became a kind of exemplar of how cities can do stuff right around Europe.
Yeah.
And actually, when you explain that, bringing together the arts, industry, people, health, doctors, medicine, you know, in one place, you know, and I say we want the Medici effect in, you know, in Bradford and in Stoke-on-Trent, people kind of get that, you know. I mean, you talked about the three things the three levers, but I'm imagining, you know, I'm leader of the council in Stoke.
Yeah.
Or I'm leader of the council in Grimsby.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm listening to this kind of in a town like that.
Yeah.
And I want to hear, you know, what tangibly could be done to kind of over a period, not going to happen overnight, but over a 5, 10 or 15 year period, I could really make my place the magical place that you think cities like that could be. Come on.
Yeah, well, I think that the answer is in the description that you gave. The Medici effect is the ability to unleash innovation. And you unleash innovation by firstly giving permission for people to innovate, and by putting in the same place the resources that force the collisions between art and science, or between, you know, capital and workers, or between enterprise and technology. So you have to assemble, I think, the civic capital that is needed for that effect to take off. So that means if you're in a smaller city or town that doesn't have a world-class university or doesn't have a large number of large businesses or a big cohort of entrepreneurs, you have to invite them. You have to find a way to create the invitation. Ask them a good question. What should be the future of this part of our city or that part of our city? You see, we're all learning, Will, I think, from the experience of places like Turin, like Bilbao, and increasingly this is...
Turin and Bilbao, by the way, are two of my favourite cities.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. So these are two post-industrial cities that have reinvented themselves around innovation and creativity, essentially by inviting the world to come in and to be part of the process of change. And, you know, in Bilbao's case, it was about the big waterfront redevelopment and creating around that a transport system and everything else. And eventually the Bondi Barra and the Guggenheim comes.
The Guggenheim's fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. But this is an example of, the Basque city inviting the world to come and be its partner in its renaissance. And Turin is a bit similar with the hosting of the Winter Olympics. It really invited the world in to think about what is the post-Fordist version of Turin beyond it being the 100-year centre of the Italian automobile
industry.
It's
also the squares and the boulevards and the covered markets.
But all of that is reinvented Turin, right? That all of that's happened since 1980. When they basically decided they had to go back to what they were before they were an industrial city, which is that they were the first capital city of Italy. They are the city of the Savoys, and they went.
That's where Italy was born.
So they went back to that, and that's why there's been the focus on cuisine, the slow food movement, the Italian film industry, this very strong focus on technology, innovation, design,
and some great museums, by the way.
Incredible. So Turin and Bilbao, I think, stand as testament to any post-industrial city or town in England that you can't do it on your own. You do need to be open-minded, and you do need to invite people to come and work with you. And the more you do that, the more you will create a sense of momentum and purpose, and the more you'll be able to build a story about the future, I think.
Before we wind it up, let's just do a bit of future gazing. Yeah. I mean... imagine it's 30 years' time. We're 2050. Yeah. So what's, how will we live then differently from now?
Yeah, well, by 2050, there'll be about 6.5-7 billion people living in cities around the world. You'll have over 1,000 cities with 1 million-plus people in them. So our small island of Britain and our relatively small cities are going to face new kinds of competition and new opportunities for collaboration as the rest of the world urbanizes and catches up. And I think this is the kind of looming story. So you've got that. You've got the climate imperative, where I think that the next 10 to 15 years is going to be absolutely critical. You talked about the challenges, Will, of retrofitting our housing stock. I completely agree. Massive challenge. I think about 2/3 to 3/4 of it can be retrofitted, but we've got to provide the financial incentives both to individual owner occupiers and to large stockholders to do it. I think that we'll be talking about primarily a post-car city in 30 years' time. I don't think much of our road spaces will be given over to individually owned cars.
Is this the 15-minute city you're talking about?
Well, I'm a bit sceptical about the 15-minute city idea.
And for those who don't know, this is really trying to organise a city around the idea that wherever you live, everything's going to be within 15 minutes walk.
Yeah. So, not a bad idea if you already live in a city that's got a metropolitan public transport system and has a metropolitan labour market and a diverse economy and everything else. The risk of promoting the 15-minute city as the model is that there's only about 10% of the cities in the world that already have those underpinning ingredients.
Yep.
So otherwise, what I think you end up with is a rich person's 15-minute city and a poor person's 15-minute city, and you don't want to live in the poor person's 15-minute city. So I think we have to be very careful about this idea that the 15-minute cities are kind of panacea. I think it works in cities that already have some of those mature systems in place, because it's about a relocalization. It's balancing metropolitanization and localization. Without the metropolitanization, the 15-minute city is a recipe for segregation, in my view. So I would be careful about that. But I'm talking about a post-car city. I'm talking about a climate-adjusted city. I'm talking about a city where digital and physical are quite blended, so that you're experiencing and operating in both realms at the same time. In 2050, I think you're also going to be talking about cities that have completely different economies from the ones that we have today, where we will have moved, I think, way out of all of the focus that we've got now on sort of mundane administrative jobs. And what we'll have much more is a strong focus on human-to-human care and experience-type activities, and we'll have a strong focus on innovation and creativity in the cities overall. I think we'll have improved connectivity between cities, of course, and there'll be many more connectivity options. But, you know, the big challenge is climate change in all of this. And, you know, our cities are both the producers of emissions, the most obvious victims of climate change, but also the places where there's a chance for us to innovate in new human behaviours and new financial models. So cities turn out to be, I think, right at the front line of the climate change challenge.
How can the people listening to this, you know, help to make this happen? I mean, who should they vote for? What should they, how should they want to be governed? What should they look for from their politicians? I mean, how can they capture some of this?
Yeah, well, I think that one way of putting this, Will, is to say that there's a big gap. There's a big gap between our expectations of what cities can do in terms of tackling climate change, building diverse economies, creating social mobility structures, and all of those things that we want of cities, and the way in which we empower urban governance structures, which is, you know, extremely poor. The superstar cities that we know so well, the Singapores, the Tokyos, the New Yorks, the Hamburgs, these are the exceptions. The majority of the 1,700 cities that, you know, that are around today, or the 10,000 cities we're going to have in 2080, are going to be cities that are seriously underpowered institutionally. And this is the political science part of the whole conversation, where we have to build new models of urban governance. And in the United Kingdom, we've made a little bit of progress in that regard with the metro mayors, with the you know, with the Greater London Authority, with the new transport authorities, with the combined authorities. We've begun some experiments, but we're way behind other places in the world. And when I was working for the OECD, I did a big comparison.
That's the Organization of Economic
Cooperation and Development.
Based in Paris, the Club of Rich Countries.
That's what it's called. But we did a big comparison of urban governance across those countries. And the UK is in the bottom decile of, you know, urban governance empowerment. So I think there's a lesson for us here that if you have high expectations of places, you need to equip them. Now, the good news for the UK is that our city leaders are good negotiators. They're very inventive. Our slightly chaotic urban governance system actually is quite innovative. But the challenge is that we have to turn these cycles of innovation into more authority. And the key issue here is tax and spend, right? The ability of our cities to raise capital, to invest in the infrastructure that they need. And at some point over the next 30 years, we're going to have some breakthroughs there. But it's a perniciously difficult issue, I would say.
And we have to solve it. Greg Clark, thank you very much. I think it's been a remarkable and energetic and energising half an hour. It's been a Cook's tour of the world's cities, from the livability of Vienna to the admirable way Turin has reinvented itself, to looking at the big English cities and Scottish cities and how well they are doing in the main. I was not aware that actually London's kind of secret lay in the compact between William the Conqueror and the burghers of London in 1067. That was interesting. You've been full of enthusiasm, pulling together kind of what we've called the Medici effect, the DNA of great cities, and the abiding kind of message from you that I take away is that these densely populated areas bring together the best of humanity. Get the structures right and you will get kind of energy and creativity, science, art and health But we have to get the structures right. And actually, in Britain, one of the structures we have to get right is how they're damn well governed.
Yeah.
And that's how we finished. But thank you so much for a very, very entertaining and interesting kind of half an hour, 35 minutes. Fantastic. Thank you, Greg Clark.
Thank you very much, Will.
Thank you so much for joining in the conversation. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends, or send us an email and tell us what we should be asking and who we should talk to. The How To Academy podcast is a bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. They invite the world's most exciting leaders, scholars, and entrepreneurs to share their ideas for transforming our lives and the world. Previous guests include Bill Clinton, Isabel Allende, Malcolm Gladwell, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Simon Sinek, Madeleine Albright, Jane Goodall, Eric Schmidt, Melinda Gates, Noam Chomsky, and many, many more. Available wherever you get your podcasts.